This is Broken Ground, a podcast digging up environmental stories in the South. I'm Leanna Furster-Rye, your host. In this season of Broken Ground, we've been talking about the critical role of environmental news in our region. We've also introduced you to a few of the talented Southern journalists who are helping to fill gaps in coverage. In our last episode, we met Paula Jaramillo and Victoria Bulabasis, two journalists finding unique ways to reach Spanish speakers in North Carolina through a publication called Enlace Latino NC.
So when this comic came out, I was blown away because it really showed me a more like empowering version, which is what I hear in my interviews and try so hard, but with words you can only do so much in print.
If you missed that episode, I hope you'll go back and listen. On this episode, I want to introduce you to someone whose craft makes visible the often invisible aspects of environmental justice issues. Here's photojournalist Cornell Watson, who on his website describes himself this way.
Dope-ass black photographer here in Durham, North Carolina.
Dope-ass black photographer. If Cornell's name is ringing a bell for you, that may be because of a small firestorm that erupted over a photo exhibit he created called Tarred Healing. It was meant to examine and honor sacred black spaces at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. Though he created it at the university's request during an artist residency there, UNC ultimately refused to display it. It's a pretty infuriating but ultimately amazing story with a rather unexpected win of an ending. We're going to talk about one of the images in this episode, but you can hear the fuller story as a podcast extra on the Broken Ground website. Today we're going to talk about Cornell's environmental photography and how he got started taking pictures in the first place.
So I kind of dabble in a couple of different things, but primarily is photojournalism and I would say like conceptual photography.
Cornell's dabbling has gotten him published in the Washington Post, the New York Times, The Guardian, National Geographic, ProPublica, and too many other publications to name. The wild thing about all his success is that he hasn't been doing any of this very long.
I got a camera a little over 4 years ago to photograph my daughter.
Yeah.
And I basically like thumbed through the manual, watched a bunch of YouTube videos, and was just educating myself on like the ins and outs of how to use this thing. And fell in love with photography.
What about it did you love so much?
Well, my grandma had like tons of photo albums of all of her kids and grandkids and great grands. And so I think I realized the importance of having photos and being able to look back on those images and be able to share with future family members and my daughter.
So then how did you get from taking pictures of your own family to taking pictures for other people?
I had a close friend that had two kids. And I started photographing their family. And then I had someone ask me if I would photograph their family and they wanted to pay me. And I was like, what is this? You know, like
money for service? Whoa.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I was like, oh, I could actually do this. Like, this is fun. And yeah, it turned into a business, into a family photography business that I did on the side while I worked my day job in HR, talent acquisition. Kind of like where things really kicked off at was in 2020 when the pandemic came along. My family photography business had basically come to a halt. And so that dream got crushed because, you know, everybody was quarantining at this point.
Right. And so this is when you kind of pivoted and you began working on a photo essay called Behind the Mask.
Yes.
So this is a really profound series of photos on being black in America that you produced following the murder of George Floyd by police in 2020.
Mm-hmm.
I would really encourage all of our listeners to check it out, and we'll link to it on our website at brokengroundpodcast.org. But that photo essay, Cornell, it was so powerful that you got it published in the Washington Post.
Yeah, in the photography section of the Post. From that point, it was like New York Times and Wall Street Journal and T-Mobile had reached out to ask me to photograph their holiday campaign for the year. And so that really just like set me up to do full-time photography, photojournalism.
What momentum.
Yeah.
So we're talking these pretty big-time clients, which I imagine these folks are coming to you with requests of their own, with visions of their own. But what to you has remained the common thread in your work?
For me, it was important to have my work centered around the Black community. And then everything else just kind of flows around that. Could be like joy related to the Black community, or it could be like serious issues, like social issues that are related to the community. And so, yeah, I kind of weave in and out of that.
And increasingly, a lot of your photography focuses on environmental issues too, right?
Yeah, think about it now. It's becoming more common, more regular. And maybe that's because, you know, there is like a ton of like environmental issues in North Carolina.
What are some of the ones that come to mind?
Bait in North Carolina and chemicals there in the water.
Right, so Baden is the site of an old aluminum plant owned by a company called Alcoa that's been closed for ages, but is still leaching toxins into the surrounding community.
Yeah. Sampson County, the landfill there, and the hog farms, and the poultry farms.
Mm.
Wilmington and PFAS, Fayetteville and PFAS.
Yeah, and for listeners who might not be familiar, PFAS are a group of man-made chemicals, also known as forever chemicals.
Mm-hmm.
Really nasty stuff, because they don't break down and they can accumulate in the soil, in the water, in our bodies.
Yeah, sadly, I feel like you could almost just point somewhere in North Carolina and you're going to find an environmental issue.
One of the first series of your photos that I came across was through SELC, the organization that supports this podcast, because SELC commissioned you to shoot a story about factory-scale hog farms,
mm-hmm.
also known as concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs. Wanted to ask kind of just what that experience was like, if you could just kind of bring us there and paint a visual for us.
You immediately see the injustice, like when you go to these places, like you can smell the injustice when you go to these places. They take hog waste, they have it out in these open air lagoons, and then they spray it around in fields that are really close to people's homes, mostly like people of color's homes, and particles travel in the air, you know, and cause all sorts of like health issues, like asthma and things that we probably don't even know about right now.
Yeah, fair. Can you imagine sitting on the porch with, you know, friends and family?
No, I cannot imagine standing on the porch, even thinking about my kids, like running around, like while you know that there's particles that are in the air.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's pretty bad all around.
Yeah. I was assigned to a story related to poultry CAFOs in Delaware once, and I had a moment where I was chasing a truck filled with chickens that were like heading to be slaughtered. And
yeah.
And one of the things that I remember from that story, and then also that struck me when looking through your photos for SELC, was just kind of, it's hard to really capture how bad it is in words and in images. And, you know, in your images, you see a barn in the distance and a field. But like, what are some of the challenges that you see of capturing what the experience is?
Yeah. There's that community fear of retaliation.
Mm, yeah.
Like the person that was guiding us around was like, you know, we can't really stop long and photograph here, even though legally, like we could photograph from the side of the road. Like we just kept it moving. So a lot of the photographs were just like, from the back seat of the car with the window down. It was raining that day, and so we're in a moving car. So it's just like a lot of technical challenges in that way, but also just like a lot of emotional challenges with how far do I push this to try to get close to some of this and capture this before it becomes like a safety issue. You have a lot of community members who are scared to like be vocal about it because there's that fear of retaliation.
Cornell, have you yourself ever witnessed anything like this, any sort of retaliation?
Yeah, there was one incident where I was in Sampson County with researchers from App State that were doing water testing. They were in a neighborhood basically doing door-to-door knocking where they were like offering free water testing. And this white guy came out of the house. We hadn't even knocked on his door yet. It was just like, what are y'all doing out here, you know, kind of thing. And I was like, hey, like, we're just like, you know, testing water. And he was like, my water's already been tested, like, get off my property kind of thing.
Goodness.
And so we left, and not even 10 minutes later, a Sampson County sheriff pulled up and pulled us over And started questioning us about like what we were doing in the neighborhood. So not only am I up against like some of the stuff, but like they are always up against, like they're living there every day. So whenever they are doing this work every single day, like those are the things that they're up against.
Cornell, is there someone that you've met along the way whose story just really sticks with you when you're thinking about water pollution or air pollution related to CAFOs?
In that same neighborhood that we got the police called on us.
Yeah.
They were doing the water testing. They were also conducting surveys. They were talking to this woman, this older black woman. And I went in and one of the first things I noticed was she had a huge like corporate water cooler in her kitchen. And I was just like, this isn't normal.
Okay, so this is one of those water coolers with a big blue 40-pound barrel that you have to turn upside down and wrestle into the stand so it doesn't spill.
Yeah, they are so afraid of drinking the water.
Yeah.
You know, like older people will like collect those roosters and porcelain turkeys or whatever and sit them on top of the refrigerator.
Mm-hmm.
Well, instead of that sitting on top of the refrigerator, it was sitting on top of the water cooler.
The porcelain chicken tchotchke on the water cooler.
Yep. And so she was sitting at the table doing her bills and she was complaining about why she even had to pay for a water bill because she had to pay for filtered water.
Yeah.
And on the kitchen table were these flowers that were like wilting away. You just look at a scene, it just kind of like told the whole story about like the impact of like environmental injustice and just like how daunting and sad it is.
That says a lot.
Yeah.
Another set of photos that we were looking through is the shoot you did to accompany an article in Mother Jones magazine last year.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an article that was co-written by Victoria Bulubasis, who was actually a guest in our last episode. And it focuses on Brent Jackson, a North Carolina state senator now in his seventh term, who's also a bigwig tobacco farmer. Can you tell us about that shoot?
Yeah, that one definitely sticks with me because, you know, we go to the grocery store, we get our produce. We don't really think about like how it got to the store, but photographing that story with Victoria, you really see a whole chain of harm to the people that help get those items into the store.
Mm-hmm.
We were at one of the houses where the farm workers were staying at, and this house, according to him, was like a big upgrade from the houses that he had stayed in before. But even that was, it makes you wonder, like, how is even legal that like this can even operate this way? The long hours that they work, you know, like these 7-day work weeks, like how is this even possible? How is the pay even possible? You know, the heat. What really is like worrisome is the fact that some of his worst experiences was working on the farm of a North Carolina senator.
Yeah.
You know, like that's a problem. And that this congressperson was in a position of power to write legislation to shield them from litigation that would hold him accountable for the working conditions that he put farm workers under. And then you have the whole other layer of the tobacco corporation funding his campaign to like basically continue like this workflow, you know, of raw goods for them. So yeah, it's just crazy. Like when you really like look at some of these stories, like that one in particular, it's really a shame that like we don't have more people that vote to make sure that people like this aren't in power.
No, absolutely.
Yeah.
In researching for this episode, we found a kind of evocative documentary photograph of yours that made it into the Guardian newspaper's showcase of 2022 photos of the U.S. Mm-hmm. In this image, we see this pool of water, a rippling reflection of a couple standing over it. In the background, you see this clear blue sky. The caption says that they're Leland and Senorita Howard, who live near the Pungo River in eastern North Carolina.
Yeah, so it's a sea level rise story, climate migration story. Actually, where they're standing at is in their front yard. It is like a canal that runs along the edge, like a ditch canal. Mm-hmm. The sea level rise, even on sunny days, they experience flooding sometimes with the way that tides come in. So because it's all connected.
So I take it this was a creative way to depict the phenomenon of sea level rise without actually, you know, showing the like typical images of streets underwater or flooded homes or that kind of a thing.
Yeah. When I went there, there wasn't any flooding, you know, like you can't quite see the impact of sea level rise because a lot of times it isn't flooded. Mm-hmm. Even for me, like this one was a learning experience because you're right, like harm is actively being done, but you can't see it.
Yeah, a lot of environmental problems facing us here in the South are really similar to that in that they're slow moving and often invisible. And it can be super tricky for journalists to convey a sense of urgency. So how is it that you convey this sense of urgency in your photos, especially with something like climate change?
Sadly, the only way to get people to really care about climate change is for them to be able to like have a connection to climate change and sea level rise. Because it's not in their backyard yet. It's in someone else's backyard. So you got to get them to connect to someone else's backyard before it's inevitably in their backyard.
I know you literally photographed Leland and Senorita Howard in their backyard, but can you say more about what you mean by a connection to climate change in this case?
For them, it is their connection to the land. Like they have been in this area. It's a predominantly Black community. Their ancestors are buried on this land. Like they have worked this land while they were enslaved. They have worked this land when they were free. All of their memories are tied to this land. So when that area is underwater, all of that history, all of that culture, all of those memories will basically get washed away.
So I know the picture we're talking about was featured in a photo spread in the Guardian newspaper, but we couldn't actually find any article associated with the image.
The story never got published. Huh. There was some disagreement between the journalist and the editor. Mm-hmm. One of my critiques on the writing was it supplied all the stats, the data, the evidence of sea level rise and climate change, but it didn't really quite bring it home all the way to the people that it was impacting. And the story loses power when it's not connected to the people or the community.
And to that point, good photojournalism is even more important. In your opinion, what is it that the best environmental photography accomplishes?
It can make or break the human connection part of the story, where you look at it and you're like, oh my goodness, like that's my mom or that's my sister, or, you know, the photography can help frame that connection where you really relate to it and you're like, oh crap, I got to do something about this, or I got to share this story, or I got to, you know, it makes you want to do something.
Cornell, would you say that you show up with that in mind every time you go out to shoot?
When I'm creating images, I'm very aware of the power of a photo and what that can do and the story that it can tell and the potential that it has to move people. It almost feels like it's like my responsibility and duty to like do it as much justice as I possibly can, because a community is depending on this work. Actual lives are depending on the impact of this work. I'm not creating the photos for myself. They really are about the people in the community and hoping that it can reach a broader audience of people who can actually like create change and do something. And at the end of the day, like that's all I can do. And then it's also a balance of like, well, I'm just one person, so I can't be everywhere. You know, I can't be everywhere.
Fair enough.
You can't be like the super savior of like, you know, of
all the causes.
Of all the causes.
And all the neighborhoods, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So speaking of neighborhoods, there's one I want to ask you about just outside Chapel Hill. You composed a photo of it for the Tard Healing exhibit we mentioned at the top of the episode. Can you tell us a little bit about Rogers Eubanks?
A historical Black community that started after Black people were freed from slavery, and they moved to that area, a bunch of different families, formed this really strong community there. And later down the road, the county / you know, city put in a landfill in their backyard, which created a lot of environmental issues.
Mm, and this is not a unique story, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the first ever National Environmental Justice Study published in 1987 found race to be the most significant predictor of where hazardous waste facilities were located in the U.S. And so Rogers Eubanks is just one of so many communities of color that have had to deal with something like this.
They didn't know anything about landfills or how they operate. And they had to educate themselves on everything. They had to learn how to do research studies and, like, you know, learn how to organize. And they did all these things over like decades of time to fight against this landfill. And now the community is starting to flourish and thrive again.
Uh-huh.
The landfill is still there, you know, but it's not causing the same level of harm that it used to cause.
So similar to the documentary photo of the woman with the ceramic rooster, you really managed to tell an entire story in this image, in this single image. But the difference is just that this image is conceptual, meaning it was staged or like a play or like a still life. Can you describe this image for listeners who haven't seen it yet?
It's a photo of the Rogers Road and Eubanks Road intersection sign. You can see the two green signs intersecting on the post. And you can see this trash piling up and peaking close to the top. Above the trash, you can see like these flowers blooming up towards the street sign. The main activist that's in the photo, his name is Reverend Campbell. He's standing on a ladder and he is pouring water from a canteen onto the flowers. It looks like a sunny sky, but it's actually a backdrop that we put up because there were like power lines and things in the background. So I wanted this image to look like really super clean and like look like a sunny, bright day, because it is becoming a sunny, bright day for the Rogers Eubanks community.
It's beautiful.
Definitely one of my favorite photos because it tells a very complex story. And it's a story that's not heard often in these type of situations. Like, it's not often that a community actually wins the fight against a landfill or that they get clean water, you know?
Totally.
And it kind of shows like what can happen when we hold landfills accountable and these communities do start to flourish again, because that's very evident with the Rogers Eubanks community.
So Cornell, we're focusing this season on the concept of news deserts or vacuums of publicly available information. And I just wanted to ask if you've sensed that absence of information in the places that you've taken assignments, or if you've maybe gone to photograph somewhere because you specifically knew there was a need.
Yeah, I think about it a lot because, like, you know, a lot of these places that we've been talking about, like, some of them have local papers and things like that, but local outlets sometimes just don't have the bandwidth to go really in depth on a story.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is important for, you know, journalists and photojournalists to come in and kind of pick up the slack when they can. I think a good example is the News and Observer doing that long form investigative journalism piece on poultry farms a few months ago across North Carolina.
Yeah, so this was a series of more than a dozen articles plus a bunch of videos and all focused on these like massive poultry CAFOs that have spread from rural areas to suburbs to the coast.
A lot of those places that they mentioned were absolutely in news deserts, and no one would have known about any of those issues had they not ran a story. And yeah, and then it eventually puts pressure on our people in positions of power to do something about it. Because even in that instance, there is almost zero regulation for poultry farms in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
You could build one in your backyard today if you wanted to, and no one would say a word.
Yeah, yeah. Any final reflections on how you think about sort of the overlaps between the work you do sort of depicting the Black Southern experience or Black Southern experiences and sort of what we think of as the environment?
I am very much inspired by the Gordon Parks approach with this. His quote that, like, he picked up a camera because he saw it as like a weapon.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I quite saw it that way in the beginning, but now I absolutely see it that way.
Mm. Can you say more about that? What do you mean exactly?
When I go to an assignment, especially going to my community or marginalized community, I am keenly aware that my camera is a weapon that can be used for good.
Mm.
The camera can be a light. The example of like news deserts, taking your camera to a place like that and being able to just kind of show the world like what's going on. Things start to happen. People start to be held accountable. It can move people to act, rally people to join a cause. It shows you the importance of reporting and the power of journalism for sure.
Well, hey, thank you so much again, Cornell. It's really been a pleasure.
Cool beans. No, thank you for having me. This is awesome.
That was photojournalist Cornell Watson. You can see some of his photos and find links to more of his work at brokengroundpodcast.org. And remember, if you're interested in hearing more about that controversy surrounding his tarred healing exhibit, you can find that story as a podcast extra on our website. So that's our final interview this season. As we were working on these last four episodes, so much was happening in the media landscape. News deserts worsened in some places. 100 people were laid off from Alabama newspapers. 6 Virginia papers announced they would be reducing their print days to 3 per week. As you now know, Southerly had to close up shop. And layoffs at the national level have become almost monthly news, too, with hundreds of jobs cut at outlets from BuzzFeed to NPR to Vox. No doubt, journalism at large is facing a massive structural crisis. And as the field has grown even more precarious, that means journalists from more marginalized backgrounds are less likely to be able to do the work and to bring the powerful lens of their life experience to it. And that's of concern for a lot of reasons. But it's far from all doom and gloom. This spring, journalists at the Texas Observer were able to save their newsroom and their jobs through a GoFundMe campaign. And small independent news outlets like Scalawag, Reckon, Verite, the Georgia Recorder, Cardinal News continue to double down on coverage of environmental justice issues, like the deeply unequal impacts of climate change and the failure of some elected officials to test for lead in public drinking water. Good local coverage has even strengthened in some places. Take the Carolina Public Press, a paper that initially covered mountain communities in North Carolina. Since launching over a decade ago, it's expanded to cover every county in the state. As we bring this season to a close, we want to use our platform as a call to action, as we think about how news deserts and the precarity of journalism right now are themselves contributing to environmental injustice. So listeners, we want to ask, do you know who covers environmental issues in your backyard? Whether that's an individual, a nonprofit, a co-op newsroom, maybe it's a good time to find them, to follow them, to support their work, or even to lend a hand with more systemic efforts that would treat journalism like the essential infrastructure that it is. We'll post some action items on our website at brokengroundpodcast.org. Brokengroundpodcast.org
Broken Ground is a podcast by the Southern Environmental Law Center, one of the nation's most powerful defenders of the environment, rooted in the South. Broken Ground is produced by Emily Richardson Lorente, Jenny Daly, Priya Mahadevan, Paige Polk, and me, Leanna Furster-Rye, with the invaluable assistance of Cobrag. Visit us at brokengroundpodcast.org to find some other great podcast-related content.